From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a coalition wants more oversight of Waukesha's efforts to tap into Lake Michigan. Plus, what we can learn about collaboration from Thomas Edison. A filmmaker and Milwaukee native looks for the meaning of life at Nevada's Burning Man Festival.
It just is so symbolic of that entire life cycle in just one week. And people come away feeling transformed and changed and touched.
And composer and guitarist Jason Seed shares his creative philosophy.
Having ideas and having them develop, for me, I just try to let them go wherever they themselves want to go. And I try to stay out of the way as much as possible.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The city of Waukesha has been toiling over a tedious application to which a lot of people are paying attention. The city has a nagging water issue. As its deep aquifer depletes, Waukesha is drawing up higher concentrations of radium, and that led to a court order to come up with a solution by 2018. And that led Waukesha to draft the first application to draw water from one of the Great Lakes after the Great Lakes Compact was sealed. Waukesha is allowed to make its case because it fits a unique criteria of the compact. The city is located within a county that straddles the Great Lakes Basin. But a collection of conservation and environmental groups called the Compact Implementation Coalition has banded together to serve as a watchdog to ensure a strong Great Lakes Compact. The group sent a letter to the Wisconsin DNR last week calling on the agency to make Waukesha's application public and to hold ample public hearings in order to allow citizens to weigh in on the process. Coalition member Peter McAvoy tells WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz the coalition's concern is the evolving nature of Waukesha's request.
They've changed where they want to get their water from, where their pipelines would be. They've changed water conservation practices. Their water use is, in fact, changing. In fact, it's been declining from what we can tell over the past several years. They also have changed significantly where they would discharge their wastewater. But none of this has been developed in a way that the general public can understand. So we're asking at this point in time that when they come in with their revised application with all of these major changes, that it be in one document, that it would be understandable to the general public. It would really do an honest and objective analysis of different alternatives that the public could understand, and that we're asking the Department of Natural Resources at this time, given all of these changes, that they hold public hearings on that document before they begin their internal review.
Aren't public hearings part of the application process? So why does the coalition feel it needs to call publicly for public hearings?
Well, that's a great question, because when the department gets to the point of actually completing its draft environmental impact statement and its technical review, it intends and will go out for public hearings. But what we're saying is that time period is actually going to be fairly short. We believe that at this time, the application itself, the revised application, should be put out for public review and comment, and the department itself will gain from the public's comments before they begin their internal review.
Okay.
And not be limited in the public's opportunity to hear and see what this new application or revised application will look like.
What's the coalition's key concerns? Is it how the DNR is undertaking the process of its review? Do you feel that they've adequately asked for a complete application?
From everything that we've seen in our dealings with the Department of Natural Resources officials, they have done what we had hoped they would do. They've been very professional about this. We think that the reason why it's taking as long as it is the department has been asking for detailed information from the city of Waukesha. How much and to what extent that information is actually answering some of these questions, we don't know at this point. But so we're not really quibbling up to this point with the way the department has conducted itself. Not at all. I honestly think because this is a complicated document, it's already, from what the city and the department is saying, is several thousands of pages long. It has changed, as I said, not only where the water will come from, how it will get out there, how it will be treated, where it will be brought back, under what circumstances, what communities will be impacted. All of that has changed over the past year, year and a half. And we would like to see that laid out in a way for the affected communities and the general public to have an opportunity to review it.
If you look at the DNR's website, and if you've gone to previous public meetings, the DNR outlines the Great Lakes Compact Review criteria for a community within straddling county. Do you find the criteria lacking in any ways, or is that a solid framework?
I guess the way I would respond to that is that the criteria that the department is employing, it really gets to the question of how it's responded to. And there's an important distinction between Wisconsin's law, its implementing legislation, and the compact provisions themselves. Now, Wisconsin has taken an interpretation of the compact that we're not sure that the other states and the Canadian provinces will agree with. But we believe that Wisconsin is trying to interpret the state law accurately. Whether or not the other states and the Canadian provinces agree is a different issue. Where we have some disagreements with perhaps how that is responded to in the application itself, and to the extent that the communities that would be incorporated into the application also fully understand what their obligations and responsibilities are and when those obligations and responsibilities are triggered, like on water conservation measures. But until we actually see the revised application and how the department is interpreting that, then ultimately, that will be, at that point, will be an important point for us to decide whether or not we agree or disagree with their decisions.
So I spoke with a DNR staffer who said that Waukesha's revised application should address the first point that the coalition pointed out, which is this revised application, and that scheduled hearings will depend on when Waukesha submits those revised materials. What's your reaction to that?
Well, we haven't seen it yet. So we've never seen a thorough analysis of some of these key components. And so we're in the dark about that, and so is the general public. So we'd like to see it, and when we see it, we'll know when we see it if it is, in fact, addressing some of these major issues. We would like to get away from these short press statements that they roll out, Waukesha rolls out, about these changes, and we'd rather see the substantive documents and see how they actually handled them.
The July 1st letter to the DNR is not the first expression of the coalition of concern about Waukesha's application to tap into Lake Michigan. What do you really hope to accomplish with this particular letter? I mean, do you think this is a pivotal time?
Well, it appears to be an important time, and we're being driven by the timeline that the city of Waukesha is putting out. We were going along and trying to track what we could from what they were saying they were proposing as part of the application. But they gave this very abbreviated, very quick timeline, saying that, well, they expect to have their application in fact, I think they were saying they were going to have it in this week, and that then they expected the Department of Natural Resources would do its internal review, and then they would be done. The state of Wisconsin would be done with its entire review, public hearings, et cetera, by the end of this year, and that it would be forwarded to the other states and the Canadian provinces for review and their comment. We thought, given the complexity of this, that when you start laying out those kinds of timelines, well, we better get the public involved in this as soon as they have a revised application so we can look at it, because it is very complicated.
Of course, Waukesha is under court order to come up with that ultimate solution.
That's correct. They do have a court order that they're living under. That's in 2018. It's interesting if they can meet their current and foreseeable future water supply needs without going through this new, very extensive process of moving water out of Lake Michigan, taking it across the subcontinental divide, using it, treating it, and bringing it back, that the shorter course of action and maybe the cheaper, more effective short-term solution, short-term being maybe several decades, that maybe it's within their power, within their existing water supplies, to meet the water and clean water, drinking water, for their residents, to meet it that way with other alternatives than this major diversion application. There are a number of practices that we were suggesting over the past several years that in combination may help the community do that. We'll see how they address that those issues in this revised application. But it really is going to come down to whether the residents of the city of Waukesha, and then in this expanded service area to include a number of the other towns outside of the city of Waukesha, whether or not those folks believe that that's the most sensible way to go. The course that they're on is going to trigger a massive review and regulatory process that we've never seen before. And why the Canadians in an article just yesterday in Toronto were pointing out that this is raising alarm bells across the border and throughout the Great Lakes Basin, because they understand that this is the first precedent for the Great Lakes Compact. And people are concerned about that in New York and Toronto and Minnesota and everywhere else.
In the coalition's heart of hearts, is it opposed on principle simply to the idea of Waukesha someday drawing water from Lake Michigan at all?
No. We have never been opposed to diversions per se. We did not oppose or get involved in a negative way with the New Berlin diversion. So our coalition is about ensuring that the compact will be effectively implemented. Just a few weeks ago, there was a major case that was brought to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it involved Texas and Oklahoma. It involved an interstate compact. That was a very important decision. This is not something to take lightly. And we're concerned that the compact and the arrangement between the Great Lakes states and the provinces will be honored and faithfully implemented. That's what we're all about. If Waukesha can make the case that it really is in a unique circumstance and that it should get a diversion and they can establish that, our coalition would go along with that. We haven't seen it yet, but it's possible that they can make that case and make a compelling case not only to the state of Wisconsin, but to the other states as well.
Peter McAvoy is a member of the Compact Implementation Coalition. He spoke with Susan Bentz. If Waukesha is to be successful, its application will ultimately require approval from all states and Canadian provinces that border the Great Lakes. There's more at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We're going to take a short break, but keep listening when we return what we can learn about collaboration from the business experience of Thomas Edison. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The image many of us have of Thomas Edison is of a single genius inventor from whom scores of remarkable technological advances emerged at the turn of the 20th century. But writer, Milwaukee native, and Edison's great-grandniece Sarah Miller Caldicott says one of Edison's most vital achievements was in assembling remarkable teams of collaborators around him in his laboratory. And in her latest book, Midnight Lunch, Caldicott says the business world has much to learn from the collaborative approach of Edison, born 166 years ago. Caldicott joined us on the line in February from the Chicago area. Good morning. Welcome to Lake Effect.
It's a pleasure.
The business world was seemingly a much different place a century ago. So why would you contend that Thomas Edison's approach to collaboration holds such relevance today?
Well, one of the things that's been true for us over the last several decades is we lived in the industrial age, a time when we were focusing on efficiency and production. A lot of organizations had what we might describe as a pyramid structure, where you have a few people at the top who give direction and provide leadership, and then there are layers of people cascading down through that pyramid that actually do the work. So as we have continued forward into the innovation age or the digital era, we're finding that these pyramid structures are a little bit more awkward. The information flows vertically, really, in an industrial age structure, but today in the digital era, information flows horizontally through the internet and other virtual systems that we've developed. In Edison's time, he worked in a very flat structure. He did not have layers of managers and supervisors. So the way he worked was actually more along the lines of this horizontal flow of information that we're seeing today as so necessary. So that's a big reason why we can go back to Edison and look at his collaborative processes for clues to success.
Of course, collaboration is not a new concept, but you write a lot about true collaboration, and so I was hoping you could share the distinction between what you see as a true collaboration and just putting together a group of coworkers in a team.
Sure. This notion of true collaboration is extremely important because, as I see it, there are really four phases to how Edison proceeded with his collaboration processes. And one of the first phases I call capacity. And within the capacity phase, there's the formation of collegiality. People feeling like they can trust each other, roll up their sleeves, and do work together. This is really one of the foundational underpinnings of what collaboration requires. If that is not present, it's much more difficult to undertake the other phases. So Edison was really masterful at driving this sense of collegiality, that people could bring forward ideas, that it was a low-risk thing to put something forward to your colleagues and actually experiment around those conversations and you know, take action on them. That's really one of the most important things we need to look at today.
Well, and that, as you say, that collegiality extended all the way to Thomas Edison. You write about his ability to get into the trenches with his team. You know, for example, in the Midnight Lunches, from which the book takes its title.
Absolutely. And Midnight Lunch is, in fact, part of this first phase that I described. A Midnight Lunch was really the practice that Edison sort of put together with his people after hours. Edison would go home for dinner. He'd come back to the Menlo Park lab or one of his other labs after 7 o'clock, would check in on his experiments, see how other experiments were faring in the lab. There tended to be 10, 12 people there on any given evening. And he would bring those people together. They'd share ideas about their experiments for a couple hours. And then Edison would order in food. And this was the midnight lunch, right? About 9 o'clock, he'd bring in sandwiches and beverages. They would kick back, sing songs, share stories, and then continue with work for another 2 hours or so. So it was the combining of their expertise, their sharing, and the social environment that led to a casual, collegial environment. So this is part of how Midnight Lunch built collegiality at the lab.
Well, and I gather there was something about how he assembled his lab teams themselves that was also novel for its time. He found what you would label an incredibly diverse group of people, all who sort of played a complementary role.
Absolutely. And this is very important for us today, to look at our teams and see how diverse they are in terms of the level of expertise that's present and the level of sort of general knowledge or contribution that's present. Edison didn't like to just have experts work on something. He liked to balance experts with generalists. So I like to think that he sort of had a two-thirds, one-third rule, if you will, that two-thirds of the people were generalists, one-third were experts and specialists. And through that process, he developed multiple perspectives in his problem-solving endeavors. This is how he generated so many disruptive innovations: recorded sound, document duplication, electrical power, motion pictures, and more. So just having experts work on something was not the way that Edison generated so many disruptive inventions.
Well, and one of the elements of collaboration you write about that I thought was especially interesting was about flawed mental models. So what can we learn from Edison's first big failure, and how do you frame it in terms of the importance of the collaborative approach?
Well, mental models are sort of the filter of how we look at the world as individuals. And Edison was always examining his own mental model and encouraged his employees to do the same. Edison's first failure actually came with his very first patented invention. And you can imagine how excited he was at age 22 to get his first patented invention. But he did not really successfully look at who was going to use this invention. It was an electronic vote recorder designed for the Massachusetts legislature. And although the legislators found that the electronic vote recorder worked perfectly, they didn't need it. It wasn't something that actually helped or addressed a need that they had. So Edison realized that he had acted on his own idea, and he hadn't really done any kind of sounding out or creating of context around the idea. So he realized his mental model, if you will, his filter, was flawed. So he changed it. He changed to looking at questions first, asking questions, trying to understand potential ways to solve a problem, and not just seizing upon one at the very beginning and pursuing that. So I think this is something we could really take on board today.
How much did Edison himself either write or talk about his philosophy of collaboration?
Well, you know, if you go through the notebooks, and there are thousands of them, if you look at court testimonies and patent filings, all kinds of documentation that we have access to via archives, there are literally millions of pages of documentation. Edison didn't really use the word collaboration. He certainly talked a lot about teams, but what we can see is the outcomes, the impact of how he was thinking about collaboration. Who did he bring together on his teams? How did he compensate them? He had profit sharing, for example, in his laboratories. This was a very new concept in his day. In Edison's time, only two people could be on a patent at once. So he had to choose between his children, as it were, when he was going forward into the marketplace, and who was going to get royalties along with himself around an invention. So this is partly why he shared the profits of the lab with others, because he knew he wasn't able to recognize the collaboration of everybody with one single patent. So we see collaboration coming forward as well in how he developed people. He cross-trained people so that they would be able to work on different projects, projects related to sound, projects related to electricity, or motion. This cross-training was part of his belief in collaboration as a central sort of heartbeat, if you will, to his laboratories. And collaboration through experimentation is another very important one. He taught everyone how to experiment, and this created a collaborative backbone, if you will, to the organization. So while we don't see him use the term collaboration specifically to a large extent, we can see it through his practices.
Well, and there is kind of an irony because here he was inventing these devices to record pictures and sound, and very little of that was ever aimed at himself. We don't have many recordings of him. He spent more time recording other people.
Yes, you know, I think this is fascinating because the man who created recorded sound through the phonograph and the record, the man who created the movies through motion picture cameras, films, and film projection, you know, didn't just stand in front of the camera or didn't just, you know, put his own voice on lots of records. He was really about impacting others and reaching out to others. So this is really extraordinary today. I think we see perhaps a different mindset operating today, perhaps more of a me focus in how innovation can come forward in the 21st century. But Edison was very outwardly focused, looking at how he could serve humankind, how he could create benefit to our daily lives, increasing the efficiency and the productivity of what we do.
Is this, would you say, an especially pivotal time to get this message out there? Is there something about the early part of the 21st century that makes this particularly important?
Well, I think there is. And a lot of it, I believe, is driven by the increasing penetration of smart devices and mobile devices around the world. Literally, there are over 5 billion mobile phones in use globally. On a planet with 7+ billion people, we see the increased penetration of smartphones and tablets and laptops as more everyday working instruments. So because of this, we have collaborative capacities that never existed before. And that's why understanding how collaboration works, what the components of collaboration are, these four phases I describe in my book, and as leaders and executives and just people operating in our everyday lives, we need to be able to recognize collaboration, to articulate what it means and what it includes so that we can be more successful and effective.
Well, Sarah Miller Caldicott, it's pretty fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
It's been great, Mitch. Thank you.
Milwaukee native Sarah Miller Caldicott's book is called Midnight Lunch, The Four Phases of Team Collaboration Success from Thomas Edison's Lab, published by Wiley. Caldicott, who is a great-grandniece of Thomas Edison, lives in the Chicago area. Our interview first aired in February. Another break now, but in just a moment, a documentary seeks to decode the meaning of life as answered in a Nevada desert. Keep listening. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. For a week each year, tens of thousands of people descend on a usually vacant spot in the Nevada desert for a festival that is equal parts performance art, philosophy, and party. The Burning Man Festival was founded more than 20 years ago and now runs each year at the end of August. It culminates with the immolation of a huge wicker man, after which the desert goes back to its previous state. Filmmaker and Milwaukee native Julie Pfeiffer headed into the desert for the Burning Man Festival last year with a basic question on her mind. And the result is the film Burning Man and the Meaning of Life, which will screen tomorrow night at the Times Cinema. Julie Pfeiffer is with us in the studio to share the story. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, we're happy to have you here. Why did you want to make this film?
Well, you know, I actually had the idea for this film almost 10 years ago. I was in school and in a philosophy class, and we're talking about the meaning of life. And those are kind of questions I've always asked myself. And I just thought that, you know, to make something thought-provoking and quite interesting would be cool. And then I came upon the Burning Man Festival just by hearing about it. And I never attended, but I always thought it was such a symbolic festival and really cool. You know, 60,000 people come to the middle of the desert. They build this huge city that's fully functioning, big, 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 like buildings and art and awesome stuff. And then they burn it all down and leave without a trace. And to me, that was really symbolic of the stages of life. So it kind of meshed together.
And you know, you described the Burning Man Festival. How much did you really know about it before you went there? I mean, what were you surprised by, and what kind of gelled with your expectations?
Yeah, you know, I watched a bunch of other, video on it to kind of prepare myself. But it's something that you can never quite prepare yourself for, because every year it's different. Every year there's different people, different art, different experiences. So I was just blown away by how big it is and how many people there are and how much there is to do. You can never experience the full festival in one year, even if you're going nonstop. So it's pretty crazy.
You said you've been thinking about doing something like this for 10 years. How much legwork did you do before you got to Nevada?
Yeah, a lot. Pre-production is huge because, you know, success favors the prepared. And so you have to have everything kind of at least buttoned down. And then that way you can break the rules once you're there. And I was actually in India when I was preparing this film. So it was quite difficult. I would have to wait until midnight to call people in L.A. And we had a cameraman in Australia, and then the camera was coming from Japan, and it was just nuts and crazy, but it was all worth it, absolutely.
It seems like the Burning Man Festival, you know, you use the term trying to have things buttoned down. It would seem like this is the kind of place where as soon as you button anything down, the buttons come open.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it such a living, breathing thing. You know, I would schedule these like interviews and stuff, and then nope, there's something called playa time. When you're there, there is no real sense of time. So we just had to kind of abandon our plan, but still kind of know what some of the stuff was going on that we wanted to cover. And, you know, we had an outline for it before we went in. So that way we could break the rules and just say, you know what, let's just go with it. But a large portion of this film is actually an installation art piece that we created. What we did is we built a photo booth in the middle of the desert.
I was going to ask about that. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, but it's actually kind of more of a soundproof thing, but sure. It had a motion-sensored camera. So every time someone went into that booth, it started recording. And so it was kind of like a confessional in a way. And we had decorated it in a way where there was questions on the walls and kind of pointed people to the things that we wanted them to talk about. But so we have hundreds of people going in that booth, and, you know, some would stay for an hour, some would stay for 5 minutes. We had people have sex in the booth. We had people do crazy things, which, of course, we didn't use all that footage for. Those are the outtakes.
Is there a director's cut that's coming
out?
Yeah.
Well, actually, we worked really heavily with the Burning Man organization, and they, you know, approve everything. And they are, you know, not wanting a lot of nudity or drugs or anything like that. So I don't know that we will release that, but maybe someday.
Which is not to say that you don't have people in this film that are talking about sex and talking about drugs and the whole experience. I mean, it seems like that would water down the experience not to touch on that.
Absolutely. And we didn't want to censor it too much. And, you know, sex is a big part of the meaning of life. I mean, we all want it. We all want to procreate and have this need to, like, survive and carry on our families. So that was definitely a portion of the film, kind of talking about why we feel that way and how that figures into the meaning of life. Definitely.
There's also a significant element of performance arts, it seems. I mean, the festival itself and some of the people that come into this booth.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the interesting thing about the festival and the meaning of life is that everybody brings something different to the table. And, you know, maybe somebody's a really good fire dancer, or maybe somebody's, you know, really good at acrobatics or building things with their hands. And so people come together and really collaborate there and just give the gift their gift. They give their art, they give themselves to each other, which is what makes it quite special and what, you know, I'd like to see more in life, in everyday life.
It seems like almost as much of a lifestyle as it is a festival. I mean, it's a festival for the week that it is there, but it's kind of a phenomenon.
Absolutely. People prepare all year long for it. And a lot of people that go tend to go multiple years in a row, 15 years, you know, it started a while ago. So it is definitely a lifestyle. And also there's 10 principles of the festival that feed into the kind of way these people and a lot of people live. And one of the big ones is the gifting community, that, you know, not everything is about, you know, making money. It's like, what do I have to give? And, you know, if we all give something something, we have more than enough to go around. And there's also a leave no trace principle, which is really great in terms of, you know, let's not litter or let's pick up our stuff. Let's be responsible for ourselves. Self-reliance is another really big one. And I think that that's amazing. So the principles also are a part of the film and, you know, and kind of touch on how it's the same and different from quote unquote everyday life.
I don't know, were you shooting on film? Were you shooting digitally? How much material did having this booth generate and how long did it take you to go through all of it?
Yeah, it was all shot digitally, HD. We had two cameras on the Playa, which is, you know, covering the festival and still talking to people there. And then the one camera that was motion censored in the booth. I had hundreds of hours of footage. And I was lucky to go. I was in France then at the time, just sitting and watching and editing. And that was my full time job.
And nice work if you can get it.
What a great job that is. And, you know, I was just so touched by a lot of it. You know, I would just be at my laptop watching this footage and crying or laughing or, oh my God, we have sex in the booth, you know. It was kind of an ongoing joke when we were building that booth. We're like, somebody's going to do it in here. But yeah, tons and tons of footage. So the post-production process was quite lengthy. But what I did as a director, and it also being a low-budget project, I went through it all and I wrote a script then. So then when I got my editor on board, she was able to really go to those moments that I wanted and help shape it in a very quick way. So I kind of saved some money doing it that way.
Well, and did you prioritize in your mind? I mean, as you look through these interviews, do you say, okay, well, you know, I already have three other people that are really kind of getting into these same themes. So, you know, as much as I'd like to include these guys, these other people are more telegenic. I don't know.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people did make the cutting room floor, which, you know, that, I mean, that happens in any film. But yeah, we didn't want it to be too repetitive because what's interesting about The Meaning of Life is everybody has a different answer, but it's all quite cohesive because it is the human experience. So we did definitely have people kind of touching on the same stuff. And yeah, you go to the people that, you know, say it in a more concise manner, maybe, yeah, look a little bit better. Some at times, you know, the audio was bad. Well, you know, that's kind of stuff gets cut right away.
Let me ask you the big picture question. Why would you say people at the Burning Man Festival have any more insight into the meaning of life than the rest of us have?
Well, I think that by going to this festival, it's kind of like experiencing a life cycle in 1 week. Because you go to this festival and that kind of is like, you know, your birth. And a lot of people say, oh, I'm home. I'm finally reborn. And they feel this kind of feeling when they come there. And then for that week, they build this community and they experience and they share and have this kind of life experience. And then at the end, they burn it all down and leave without a trace, which is death. And a lot of people, when the temple was burning, which is a really large structure and kind of the spirituality of the Playa, when that burns, people talk about rebirth. And so it just is so symbolic of that entire life cycle in just 1 week. And people come away feeling transformed and changed and touched.
Was there a biggest challenge you found as you were trying to, I mean, you only had a week to work with while you're there.
Yeah, well, and that's why that booth came into effect and was just kind of a big part of the presentation from the beginning of, you know, that's how we can capture people and kind of give them a space where, you know, if I have a camera in somebody's face, they might not feel as able to have those intimate moments. So that really helped us, A, get more people and really capture those, that intimate, like, this is how I'm feeling, you know, and this is what I think kind of moments. So it was a lot to cram in. We were going nonstop, waking up for sunrise and going until the nighttime. And, you know, we had aerial shots. We got to go in an airplane. We got to talk to the founder. You know, we were all over that place. But, you know, go big or go home, right? I mean, we're there for a week and we're gonna do it. So yeah, it was really just a great experience. And I loved just talking to everybody there. It was amazing.
Well, and so then as the filmmaker, what was the message or what were the messages that you heard from people that stuck with you that you think the rest of the world could or should learn from Burning Man?
Well, I think if you want to know the meaning of life, you have to watch the film. No, I'm just kidding.
No spoiler alert here.
I'm just kidding. Absolutely. You know, like I said, we touched on so many different topics and had so many different perspectives. But I can boil it down in one word. The most often spoken response response, or the most cohesive response, was that the meaning of life is love. And that can take a lot of different forms and mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But that kind of really covers the gamut of answers and kind of inspires people.
Does everything you do from here on out, is it informed by the stuff that you learned while you're there?
You know, and I do think about it all the time. I personally, as an individual, as well as a filmmaker, learned so much by doing this film and was so touched. And I really hope that the film kind of sparks a debate or a discussion, or, you know, just someone thinking about their own life and kind of finding that purpose. And, you know, ever since I was young, I kind of wondered, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? And what can I do to maximize my time? And I definitely live life to the fullest. I am constantly going, constantly trying to, you know, do bigger and better things. And I think that it's only going to get better from here. And the meaning of my life is to tell messages and convey interesting, you know, ideas and topics to people through film.
Well, Julie Pfeiffer, hope you tell them to us down the road.
Absolutely, I'd love to. Thanks, Milwaukee. I'm so glad to be home.
Milwaukee native Julie Pfeiffer is director and producer of the documentary Burning Man and the Meaning of Life. She lives in California now, but she'll be on hand for a screening of the film tomorrow night at the Times Cinema at 60th and Valit, along with some fire dancers from the Wisconsin Burning Man organization. There is a link to more about the movie from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then we'll catch up with composer, guitarist, and the founder of a Milwaukee-based string tet, Jason Seed, when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. When we last had the Jason Seed String Tet in the studio, the group had just released its first album, The Escapist. Last week, their sophomore effort, In the Gallery, was released. Much like the first album, this one blurs the lines between genres and incorporates jazz, folk, and classical elements all within a classical composition structure. The group will play a CD release party tomorrow evening at Sugar Maple in Bayview. They didn't bring their instruments along, but Seed, bassist Dan Armstrong, and violist Helen Reich joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio, and Jason Seed talked about his inspirations for this latest album.
I write pretty compulsively, so I throw out at least 90% of the stuff that I write. So this is the good bits, the good stuff. But as far as any kind of distinct overall plan, I guess there really isn't much. You know, it's a lot of scattered ideas that seem to fit together well, I think.
I think they do melodically. I mean, to me, as I was listening through the whole album, things hang together, even if they're not like one movement to another movement to another movement.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
still, they still fit together.
Yeah. And in this, I kind of, there's a lot of utilization of song form type structure to a lot of the pieces, which I think lends itself to a certain kind of accessibility to people, you know, in a certain sense. A lot of it, you could actually, you know, think of it as having verse and chorus type orientations here and there, you know, usually with something kind of plopped in the middle.
I find it's interesting you're asking Jason about his compositional, what motivates him and everything, and we have a hard enough time getting that out of him too. He doesn't tend to write even as much as a Allegro Vivace above the parts. It's basically up to us to figure out where the tune is going.
So in yeah. some ways, you as the string tet are co-composers.
Mm-hmm. I feel that way.
In a way, certainly, yes, definitely. Yeah. As far as dynamics, as far as where do the phrases go, articulation as well. And we might change from one rehearsal to the next our idea of how we want what we want the piece to be like. So, yeah, we in a way are co-composers, yes.
I think it lends itself to a real organic development process as well. We work through something, get to the point where everybody has put in some opinion in one way or another, and everybody kind of reaches some type of democratic comfort level or something. I'm not
some
sure.
sort of conclusion that everybody's happy with.
Yeah.
Now, so for Dan and Helen, working on this new album and these new pieces, was it different for you from the last one? I mean, musically, did you find anything different?
Well, I love both albums, really. And no, I would have to say no. Really, you know, actually some of these pieces are old. Caterpillar Keef, for instance, that one has been around for a long time. Jason, when did you compose that?
Oh, geez. A long time ago.
Long time.
7 years ago or something.
Okay.
But
yeah.
it's kind of like there's a piece called Krakow, too, that, you know, these have gone through extensive revisions. Krakow mm-hmm. used to be really brief. I mean, I wrote at the beginning of the theme on a train leaving that city in Poland. And, you know, since then it's gone through. I would jokingly, bring in pieces that would say Krakow 2.0, Krakow full bore, Krakow I swear it's almost done, Krakow I have no idea what we're doing now, you know. So yeah. Which version this is, I don't even know.
Right.
And some of them were newer, though. Ishtar is a pretty new tune.
Yeah.
Oh, some of them were written practically yesterday. There's one piece that's just a guitar and cello piece, in the right light, and that one just got written, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and that's a beautiful piece, too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That's what was on. Yeah.
Oh, so yes, we should mention that you've made the ATC bumper music file,
right?
Which is for, you know, anyone who's listened to All Things Considered or Morning Edition, for that matter. There's always that little snippet of music at the end of a segment before they hit the underwriting credit, and that's to basically fill time, you know, or to set a mood or something like that. And sometimes it can be as much as 15 or 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Usually, it's more about 5.
Yeah.
So how much did you get?
15 or 20.
30 seconds.
30 seconds?
That's
yeah.
fantastic.
Yeah, I guess, which for that segment, I guess, is kind of epic.
Yeah, it really is. Has anyone, phoned up and said, who was that?
I don't know.
That we don't know.
I certainly hope so.
That we don't know.
You mentioned Ishtar, and that's the bass piece, isn't it?
No,
which one's the bass piece?
In the gallery. Well, actually, Ishtar has an extended bass solo at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yes,
right,
it does. Because I was listening to that going, now that's interesting.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Good.
So what was that like to work on?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. And I find every time I play it, I find something new to do to it or do with it. You know, and that's one of the problems with recording, in a way, is that there it is. And then the next day you find, oh, I can do this with it too, you know. And then the piece actually has a fairly driving bass line too.
Which is and the bass solo is like a real cadenza in a classical music piece. It's a real cadenza. It uses parts of the piece. It takes thematic material from the main part of the piece and puts it into the solo bass. So it's great.
I didn't know that. I'm glad you told me.
Absolutely. You didn't know?
Yeah.
You never realized that? Absolutely it does. Yeah.
So this was written out, though. This is not something that was improv.
Yes.
Yeah. The thing that I liked about it is that it sounded improv.
Right.
You know, and I know that's key for what you do, Jason, because this all sounds like, yeah, you have basically a melody, but you're all sitting down and you're just kind of like jamming on it and figuring it out. And I know it's far more rehearsed than that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's all written out. I mean, there are little segments of improvisation here and there, but like the backgrounds for the improvisations are written out. And I guess the main improvisation parts are Glenn and I, so the violin and the guitar.
Because, you know, I know, Helen, you're primarily a classical mm-hmm. player.
Yeah.
And Dan, are you as well? Or do you also do, more jazz bass and that sort of thing as well?
Primarily classical. I find it kind of hard to – it's pretty hard to do both physically as much as anything. To do a lot of jazz would be pretty taxing. And I'd have a hard time keeping up with the classical sound that I have to
do and produce.
Yeah.
But I would think that playing music like this that Jason writes gives you an opportunity to kind of play in that pool a little bit without having to become jazz players.
Exactly.
Yes, that's right.
I feel like I can pretend. You know? I think I can have a jazz feel without being a full-fledged jazz player who can just read chords and improvise on them without thinking.
There is something great about the way you do this, Jason, because I always, whenever I hear your music, I think, oh, well, this is jazz. No, wait, it's classical. No, wait, it's this. It's, you know, and you kind of move between all those genres very, very neatly, it seems.
Thank you.
You know, or maybe there's just no lines. It's sort of those, they become amorphous and it just kind of,
that's how it is for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because a lot of things are just, I mean, from a compositional point of view, all these different genres, you can consider them colors or something. You can consider them like, if you have an idea and you put it in a specific genre, it's kind of like similar to if you have a specific melodic idea and you put it in a certain harmonic context, you know? So having ideas and having them develop, for me, I just try to let them go wherever they themselves want to go. And I try to stay out of the way as much as possible, in a sense.
I think it seems to me that you can channel certain aspects of various types of music without having to be an expert on, you know, Bulgarian music or you know, Cajun zydeco or whatever. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You can hear something in those and then write your own thing. And I think that's what Jason does. And I think it's a kind of a very intellectually honest thing to do. You know, you're just writing your own thing based on what you've heard and what you've been influenced by.
Well, I was going to say composers from time immemorial have done that. I mean, how many times did Mozart borrow from folk tunes, you know?
Oh, sure. Yeah,
or,
course,
you know,
yeah.
Bartok writing, you know, Hungarian things, but they weren't Hungarian dances. They were his, you know.
Or
how much
did Mozart really know about Turkish music when he wrote the Turkish Rondo?
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
But like you say, it influences whatever you do.
Yeah.
And then it becomes your own.
Yeah, and I like the idea of staying where all the kind of edges of those things meet, which is kind of where the title Where the Corners Meet came from, is just having things be whatever they are in their own area. So it's not, you know, when people say, is this jazz or is this classical or is this this, I just kind of say, well, yeah, sure.
It is. Well, I wish you the best of luck with the CD. It is called In the Gallery. It is the Jason Seed Stringtet. We've had Helen, Dan, and Jason here today, and I can't wait to hear you at Sugar Maple. Looking forward to it.
All right.
Thank you,
Bonnie.
Thank
you, Bonnie. Thanks, Bonnie.
Composer and guitarist Jason Seed spoke with Bonnie North, along with violist Helen Reich and bassist Dan Armstrong. They, along with violinist Glenn Ash and cellist Scott Tisdell, make up the Jason Seed Stringtet. Their latest album is called In the Gallery, and they'll play a CD release show tomorrow night at Sugar Maple in Bayview. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The Jason Seed Stringtet takes us out this morning. I'm Mitch Tyke. It was great to have you with us today. You'll find us here every weekday morning at 10 and weekend afternoons at 3. Join us again tomorrow when we'll explore the financial fortunes of Harley Davidson as the iconic Milwaukee motorcycle manufacturer prepares to celebrate its 110th anniversary next month. Thanks again for tuning in today. Stay tuned for Fresh Air on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock.